and get started. So, what are we going to do during the 3 days that we have here? Today, we'll look at textual evidence, okay? This first session is almost exclusively descriptive. In other words, we're just looking at passages where the New Testament mentions women and just seeing what they do, okay? We're not saying they should do that or shouldn't do that now. We're just describing what they do. The second session, we'll try and think theologically about gender. What does it mean to be male and female in God's eyes? We can think about gender biologically, right? We can think about the social construction of gender, the ways that male and female are viewed differently by different societies. But how does God think about male and female? And that's what we'll do in the second session. And then the third session is thinking pastorally. What does it look like in congregations that have decided to have more inclusive activities for women in the life of the church? Okay? So those are the kind of the three movements. Let me tell you a little bit about who I am. My name is Ken Sikrowski. I serve as the Dean of the College of Biblical Studies. I teach New Testament and Greek. I've been at ACU since 1999, so this is the beginning of my 18th year. And I'm here because I love Scripture. That's why I ended up getting a PhD in New Testament, and I still love Scripture. And I think Scripture informs the faith and practice of the church. And so if I'm going to do something, I would like to know what Scripture says. I think Scripture is authoritative for our faith and our practice. For those of you that are coming in, there are some handouts down here at the front. Feel free to come and get one. In terms of my role in relationship to you, the verse that comes to my mind is 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 6, where Paul said, I planted, Apollos watered, and God gives the increase. So, I am really comfortable being a planter, and so there's a handout there, there's some information, there's some seeds for you to think about, right? I'm also really comfortable to be a waterer. You have questions, great. You notice I put my email there at the top of the page. You can talk to me afterwards as well. You can talk to me beforehand. I'm not comfortable, however, being God. Okay? So the first two I'm really comfortable with. Planter, waterer, totally comfortable with that. The whole God thing in terms of providing the growth and increase, that's kind of between you and God. And so my role is not the third one. My role is the first two, is kind of planter and waterer. So I'll describe part of my journey as I plant and water. Here are some of the scriptures that I looked at. Here are some of the thoughts, and here are some of the questions. But in terms of the growth, that's going to be between you and God. And I think that's appropriate. And that's kind of how we'll proceed in that way. So, let's go ahead and start. Let me begin by describing how we're going to start. So, what I ended up doing was looking at all the women in the New Testament, okay? And so the first part was easy, because there's about 51 women that are named, and so you can go and you can look at the names of the women and see what they're doing. Okay, and then the next thing I did was I just started picking out all the terms that describe something female and human in the New Testament. Okay, so girl, woman, female, foolish woman, old woman, mother, barren, without mother, daughter, sister, virgin, bride, wife, daughter-in-law, mother-in-law, so on and so forth, right? So all the terms that could describe someone who is female in the New Testament. And then looked at all of those passages, okay? And the interesting thing is, even after you do that, there are some other passages and some other people that we may not have captured. And I describe them as invisible women. I think there are women there in the text that may not come up just because there's a female name or some female term. And let me give you an example. Look at Luke chapter 1, the preface, verses 1 through 4. I'm going to read those four verses, and you tell me, so where is the woman, or is there a woman, in this passage, okay? For those of you that have come in, there's handouts down here at the front. Feel free to come down and grab one. They're on either side. So, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things which have been accomplished among us, just as they were delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the truth concerning the things of which you have been informed. So, did you notice any possibilities for women being mentioned there?
Yes, when it says the eyewitnesses.
Eyewitnesses.
The man that talked to the eyewitness women, because so many accounts, only women were there when it was happening.
Right, and as you read through the gospel, we see at the cross, at the tomb, there are women who are eyewitnesses, right? In Luke chapter 8, we read about women who followed Jesus in his ministry. We read about stories of Jesus and women who were there, right? And so there are eyewitnesses. Now, would you pick out the word eyewitnesses and think, oh, we're talking about women there? Well, it's not feminine. It doesn't mention a woman's name. That might be a woman that we might miss, right? There's also some kind of language difficulties. So, third person plural in French, Spanish, and Trudeau-Bury, you can't always tell what kind of group you have, okay? So if it's all women, you'll have a female gender there, okay? If it's all male, you'll have a male gender. If it's a mixed group of males and females, what will you have? All male. So can you tell when you have a third person plural they if it's all male or if it's a mixed group? You can't. And so some of the times when there's a they, like teachers, and it's masculine, it may be all men, but it may be a group of males and females. So that one is a little bit ambiguous, okay? And on the list, you'll notice that some of the times that I put citations down, there's a question mark after that. And why is that? Well, because I'm trying to play fair. It's a possibility, okay? I'm not saying that is in fact true. I'm saying, think about it. Maybe true, may not be true. We don't know, okay? The other area of invisible women that I'll name is sometimes in stories we may have presuppositions about what's there. So for instance, I grew up in ancient times when we had things called flannel graphs. Okay? Some of you have never heard of those things, don't even know what I'm talking about. Okay, but as people told stories, they put up little flannel pictures, people on a board, and you saw the story kind of unfold before you, okay? I also grew up in a time when, you know, you would be given a little handout that had the Bible story and there'd be pictures on there. Almost all of you, probably many of you at least, grew up with illustrated children's Bibles, right, that depicts the story. And so you may have in your mind what that story looks like because of pictures you've seen and so forth, okay? So, for instance, the story of the road to Emmaus, where Jesus is walking along with two disciples. As you picture that in your mind, we know that one of them is named Cleopas. What does the other one look like? Does the other one look like a guy, and it's two guys that are walking along talking to Jesus? Or is it husband and wife, Cleopas and his wife? We don't know who this other person is. We know that they take Jesus into their home. So is it possible that it could be a husband and wife? It's possible, right? But do I have a picture in my mind that precludes that possibility from even existing as I read the story? Okay? For me, the answer is yes, because I grew up with Jesus walking along with two guys, which may in fact be the case, okay? I'm not saying that it is something different. I'm just saying, as we read the text, we may have presuppositions that prevent us from seeing something that could be there, okay? So those are the kinds of things that I mean by invisible women, okay? So there's some that are really clear. Woman's named, there's a female descriptor. There may be some other ones that aren't clear, but still may be present. So with that in mind, let's go ahead and start to take a look at the categories that are mentioned there. And obviously, there's going to be a little bit of a highlights version here, right? Because we're not going to be able to go through every single passage and discuss it, okay? But I gave you a handout, so in your own time, you can go back and you can take a look at it. So the first category is female deacons, okay? So if you look at Romans chapter 16, you have a woman who is named Phoebe, and she is described as a diakonos. And the word diakonos could be translated deacon, and it is in relatively few places, but some places in the New Testament. It could be translated servant. It could be translated minister. All of those are translations that you see within the New Testament. So how do you decide how you should translate? Okay, well, translators are making a decision for you. And if you have a good study Bible, they'll at least tell you what some of the options are. Other translations say such and such. Or if you have other translations, it's always good to look at those other translations to see if there are other options. And if you're seeing other options in the translation, then that at least lets you know, hey, something's going on here, right? And some translators are making some decisions. What do I think about this? And so we find the description of Phoebe as a diakonos, what? Of the church at Cenchrea. So in her role as diakonos, it's in relationship to the church at Cenchrea, right? So we also read a further description of her that's she's been very helpful, right? And so it's certainly possible that Phoebe is a female deacon. A good kind of question to ask here might be, if her name were Phoebus, male, how would we translate it? Would we translate it deacon, or would we translate it differently? And why would we translate it differently? And what exactly does diakonos mean? Well, one of the reference books in my library is a shorter Greek English lexicon, and one of the things that it does is it tells you the roots that things come from. And so if I want to know what a word means in Greek, I can go to that lexicon and it'll help me out with that. And the unfortunate part is when I go and I look at that lexicon, it says derivation unknown. Well, that's kind of a bummer because I was hoping to try and find out what diakonos means. So what do I do next? Well, the thing I do next is I look at the other words that it plays with, right? What are the other words in the context that are associated with that word? And it's pretty clear. And diakonos is a very common word. So unlike some other times when we don't have a whole lot of evidence, we actually do have a lot of evidence. And diakonos is one of the most general, if not the most general, words for a servant. And you can find a diakonos doing lots of things, just like servants did lots of things in the ancient world, okay? And so we're talking about someone who is a servant of the church, okay? Now, as deacon kind of moves along, it kind of grows into something perhaps larger, right? Like an office. But originally, a diakonos is describing a function, someone who serves. Because if you go to look for the job description of a deacon in the New Testament, there isn't one, right? All we have to go on is what the word means, and it's a servant. And even the word deacon isn't a translation of diakonos. It's a transliteration, substituting English letters for Greek letters, like baptizo, baptism, right? That would be a transliteration. A translation of baptism would be something like submerge, dip, immerse, right? And so deacon is more of a transliteration of diakonos. Servant would be more of a translation of diakonos, okay? You also have a passage in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 11, in the context of describing deacons, and it says, now the women, and then it gives a description of the types of women, okay? And it says women should be serious, not slanderers, and temperate. Now, in the description of the male deacons in verse 8, the very first description of the men is that they should be what? Serious. The exact same word used of the women. The second one is not double-tongued, referring to their speech. The second one for the women is not slanderers, referring to their speech. The third one for the men is not addicted to much wine. The third one for the women is temperate, both of them describing moderation. So in the description of the kind of men that we're looking for, the very first word is exactly the same as the women. The next two are same categories, right? Looking at speech and moderation. And so it's possible that the women there are female deacons. And some of your translations may have something like that because it's a bit ambiguous. It could be female deacons, or it could be the wives of the deacons, okay? The difficulty with it being the wives of the deacons is that if it's so important that a deacon's wife be upright, have good moral character, why is nothing said about elders' wives, right? And so that's just kind of a red flag that made folks say, is there any other options for translating this passage? And yes, there are other options. The other option being that we might have a female deacon being talked about. The third passage is a little bit of a strange passage. It's Philemon verse 2. And in Philemon verse 2, you have a woman named, and her name is Apphia. And I have to confess that whenever I thought of Apphia, which wasn't very often, okay? But whenever I thought of Apphia, I thought of her as Mrs. Philemon, okay? But there's really a difficulty with that because the you in verse 2, the church that meets in your house, is singular. So Apphia and Philemon aren't husband and wife, okay? Because we look at other husband-wife couples like Priscilla and Aquila, and when it talks about, you know, the church meeting in their house, it uses plural there. So it could be that Apphia is a deacon. Why might we say that? Well, because when we look at the salutations, the greetings in Paul's letters, except for churches as a whole, the only group that's mentioned in Paul's greetings are bishops and deacons in Philippians 1:1. In other words, Paul greets the leaders of the church there. And so it's possible that Apphia and Archippus are leaders of the church there. Perhaps deacon, perhaps elders, okay? What do we know? Not a whole lot, just her name in a listing there. So what do you get on my sheet? You get a big question mark. But it's kind of interesting, right? So the third person plural comes into play in the Philippians 1:1 passage when it talks about deacons, plural, and the deacons is masculine. You don't know if that's a group of all males or a group that's mixed males and females. And so I gave you a question mark there. Outside of the New Testament, we have a Roman official named Pliny, and Pliny is the governor of the province of Bithynia, which is in northern Turkey, around 112. He comes into office 111, leaves office 113. I'm going to split the difference, say we're around 112, which puts us early in the second century. And so why is the information from Pliny important? The information from Pliny is important because Pliny isn't Baptist, he isn't Church of Christ, he isn't Methodist, he isn't Presbyterian. He didn't have a horse in this race, okay? In fact, he's a Roman official who doesn't know about Christianity, and because he doesn't know about Christianity, he's writing to the Roman emperor saying, what should I do about these folks, okay? And what does he do? He describes them as follows. After this ceremony, it had been their custom to disperse and reassemble later to take food of an ordinary, harmless kind. But they had, in fact, given up this practice since my edict issued on your instructions, which banned all political societies. This made me decide that it was all the more necessary to extract the truth by torture from two slave women whom they call deaconesses. So early in the church, we have deaconesses. And as you go through church history, you see other places. This is probably the earliest reference to that. And part of the role of deaconesses was in baptism, because some of the early baptisms were done without clothing, and the early church thought it'd be better if we had women baptizing the women there, okay? And we see that in the language of the putting off and taking off language that's found in baptism. Okay, so some possibilities there. Second category, female patrons. Now, in the 21st century, sometimes when you give money, people will put your name on a building, okay? And back in the first century, it wasn't a whole lot different, okay? And so in the first century, we find the names of both men and women on buildings and in inscriptions. And in fact, the structure of the early Christian society was a patron-client kind of relationship, okay? Folks who had power, position, money used that influence to help others, both Christians and non-Christians. And in fact, if that's the way the pagans dealt with others, wouldn't we presume that Christians also deal with others in that same way, right? And so, is it surprising that you would find some female patrons in the New Testament? Now, in the church that I grew up in, if you had asked the question, how did Jesus pay for his ministry? We would have said, I don't know. Which is really kind of interesting, because we were really a strong book, chapter, verse kind of people. And I'm pretty sure that we had read Luke chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, that describes some men and women who traveled around with Jesus. And of the women, it says, chapter 8, verse 2, there were some women who had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities, Mary called Magdalene, from whom seven demons had gone out, and Joanna, the wife of Cusa, Herod's steward, and Susanna, and many others who provided for them out of their means. Well, why is it that that wasn't one of the stories that I heard growing up? I don't know. We just didn't see that when we read the text. I don't think there was any bad feelings on our part. We just didn't notice those kinds of things. But as I started looking up all the passages where women are mentioned, I started noticing some stories that I hadn't heard before. And one would be that of female patrons. Again, we have Phoebe, who is mentioned in Romans 16, 1 through 2. There's a term there, prostatus could be translated helper, could be translated patron or patroness, could even be translated ruler, governor, or manager. I think it's probably talking about her as a patron. Cenchrea is a port city. Lots of traffic goes through there, both commerce and travel. And it wouldn't be surprising if Phoebe provided funding, lodging for people who were passing through. Corinth, large city on the isthmus. Cenchrea, one of the port cities on either side of the isthmus there. And so would Phoebe function as a patroness, providing food, lodging, other kinds of help? Seems very likely, right? And so other ones that seem likely to me are the prominent women that are mentioned in Thessalonica in Acts 17, verse 4, the prominent Greek women in Berea, 17:12 of Acts, perhaps Chloe. Chloe has people, and so perhaps she's a person of influence with slaves. Question mark there. We don't know a whole lot about Chloe. Other question mark is, if you owned a house and you were a host of a house church, might that also come under the category of patron? Perhaps. And so I put a question mark there. Third category is female apostles, which sounds a little bit like we're doing a Dan, you know, Brown novel or something like that, right? But we're not. Because in the first century, Jesus had 12 apostles, and I kind of think of those as apostles with a capital A, even though in Greek it's not a capital A, okay? The 12. But as you can see from the references there, there are also a number of other folks who are called apostles in the New Testament, like Barnabas, Titus, Epaphroditus. And why are those people called apostles? Because, again, I kind of think of this as apostle with a little a. This is a person who has been sent forth. That's what apostello means, being sent forth. And these folks were sent forth with a task. For example, Epaphroditus was sent forth to go see Paul. And so we can talk about him as an apostle, someone that the church sent forth. And it appears that Andronicus and Junia, a husband-wife team, had been sent forth by the church. They had done a good job, and they were commended for it, and Paul recognizes their service. The other place that I think is kind of interesting, and I put a question mark because I don't know, when Jesus sends out the 70, 2x2, again, in my mind, I always kind of imagined them as pairs of guys. Perhaps because I had Mormons visiting my house in pairs of guys. Okay? Perhaps also because in the New Testament you have these pairs that go out, right? But is it possible that some of those 70 could have been husband-wife teams or even two females? I think that's kind of interesting as a possibility and kind of transitioning into the next category there, missionary ministry teams. We've already mentioned Andronicus and Junia that look like a husband-wife team, and the husband's mentioned first. We have another husband-wife team that's mentioned, Priscilla or Prisca and Aquila, and the interesting thing there is four of the six times when they're mentioned, her name is mentioned first, which is a little strange. It's not something that never happens, but there's usually some kind of reason, much like now, if I introduced Mrs. and Mr. Johnson, that would sound a little strange because we usually put the Mr. first, right? They usually put the guy's name first, unless there's some kind of prominence with education, position, wealth, something, okay? And so there's something that makes her name come first four out of the six times, which is kind of interesting. So it looks like we have a couple husband-wife teams that are functioning as ministry teams. And so what I did next was just look up all the people in the New Testament that come together as pairs, okay? So what do we get? We have a female-female pair, Tryphena and Tryphosa. Their names sound very similar. I kind of think of them as twins. I have no evidence for that. That's kind of what I think of, Tryphena and Tryphosa, okay? And six other pairs, Joanna and Cusa, the 70, Cleopas and the unnamed companion, apostles and their wives, brothers of the Lord and their wives, Philologus and Julia, Nereus and his sister, all have big question marks after them because I have no idea if they're functioning as ministry teams or not. But I do know that Jesus sent out workers two by two in Luke 10, okay? And later on in Luke 19, 29 and 22:8, he sends out pairs. And then when you get to the book of Acts, you see Peter and John, Paul and Barnabas, Judas and Silas, Paul and Silas, Barnabas and Mark going out as pairs. And so it wouldn't be surprising if other pairs that we see in the New Testament could be ministry teams. Do I know any of those are? No idea. Okay? But I at least assembled the evidence there, put question marks after that as some kind of possibilities. Okay? Fifth category, female hosts of house churches. So there are references to house churches in the New Testament. Some of them have males named as hosts of those house churches. Gaius in Romans 16, Philemon in Book of Philemon, Jason in Acts 17, Titus Justus, Acts 18. Okay? So it's not as though we don't have both males and females functioning as hosts of house churches. With the females, we have Mary in Acts chapter 12. When Peter is released from prison, where does Peter go to find the church? Finds the church at Mary's house. When Paul is released from prison in Philippi, goes to Lydia's house. Why? I suspect that Lydia is functioning as the host of a house church there. We have Prisca and her husband hosting in Rome and in Ephesus, likely in Colossians 4, Nympha, possibly also Phoebe in Romans chapter 16. So it seems that if you're a Christian in the first century and you had access to a large enough house for folks to meet in, there were some men and there were some women who were generous with their property and used that property for the church to meet. At that point in time, we don't have church buildings, and folks are meeting where they can, okay? And some of those places are houses that are owned by men, and some of those places are houses that are owned by women there, okay? Category number six. Female co-workers. So you have a number of men whom Paul explicitly uses the term co-worker with, 13 to be precise. When you look at that same term, co-worker, and look at women, you have three that are mentioned, okay? You have Prisca, who's mentioned in Romans chapter 16, verses 3 through 5, and you have Euodia and Syntyche, who are mentioned in Philippians 2 and 3. The interesting thing about Euodia and Syntyche is that it says they struggled side by side with me in the gospel. And the phrase in the gospel is a phrase that requires some reflection, because the word gospel can refer to the content, what is preached, or it can refer to the activity, preaching, right? So which makes more sense? They struggled side by side with me in the content of the gospel, or they struggled side by side with me in the preaching of the gospel? Okay? And if you look at Romans chapter 1, verse 9, and 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 2, you can look at other places where you get that exact same prepositional phrase, in the gospel there. Okay? And what's also interesting is we're in the province of Philippi, which is in Macedonia. And within the ancient world, the Roman Empire, there were some places where women were just more prominent in public. And one of those places is Macedonia. Macedonia had women on coins. Macedonia had female regents and co-regents. And so if there were going to be any place in the Roman Empire where you would expect early Christian churches to have a more open attitude toward women, it would be in the province of Macedonia, and Philippi is in that province there. Category number 7, female laborers. So there are a number of women who have this term work or labor associated with their name: Mary, Tryphena, Tryphosa, and Persis. And if you look at the descriptions there in Romans chapter 16 of Mary, Tryphena, Tryphosa, and Persis, what you notice when it describes their work is that it isn't just that, oh my gosh, they make incredible vases, or have you ever seen the silversmithing that they do, right? So look at verse 6, greet Mary who has worked hard, what? Among you. Who's the you? Church at Rome, right? Verse 12, greet those workers, what kind of workers? In the Lord, Tryphena and Tryphosa. Greet the beloved Persis who has worked hard, where? In the Lord. So the context of their working hard is in the context of the church there. And so this word labor, work hard, can just refer to work in general. There's lots of places in the New Testament where it does. But it can also refer to the work of ministry. And I include a whole bunch of passages there, right? So what becomes really interesting is when you look at a passage like 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verses 15 and 16. I'll begin in verse 15. Now, brothers and sisters, you know the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Achaia. They devoted themselves to the service of the saints. I urge you to be subject to such ones and to every fellow worker and laborer, to every person who is a co-worker and laborer, you should be, as a church, what? Subject to them. And so here is a place where you have the word submit, be subject to, being used to describe a function that includes both men and women within the life of the early church, because women are called co-workers and women are called laborers. And Paul says, if they're performing that function, you should be subject to every co-worker or laborer, which is an interesting kind of passage, right? Okay, just in case you didn't think that was interesting, let's look at number 8, female prophets. So when you look, when you break out your concordance and you look up prophet, prophetess, you find in the Old Testament, the folks that are listed there, the most interesting by far to me, as I looked at it, was Huldah, who is a prophetess there, listed in 2 Kings 22, parallel passage, 2 Chronicles. And when the book of the law is found, they say, what shall we do? Well, we need to go inquire of the Lord. And so the high priest and the king go and ask Huldah, what should the nation of Israel do? And Huldah says, thus saith the Lord. So you have a woman articulating the will of God for the king, the high priest, and the whole nation of Israel. Perhaps your church was different. I didn't grow up hearing the story of Huldah. When I broke out my concordance, read about Huldah, I'm pretty sure it's the first time that I remember reading about Huldah. Maybe I'd read about Huldah before, but I certainly hadn't heard that story, okay? So when you come to the New Testament, there's also some passages that talk about women as prophets. You have Anna, you have a quotation from Joel in Acts chapter 2, Philip's four daughters prophesy, you have women who pray and prophesy in 1 Corinthians 11, 5, perhaps Elizabeth, perhaps the women in 1 Corinthians 14, and you have a false prophet, Jezebel, just like you have some false prophets in the Old Testament who are both male and female. So my question here is, what does a prophet do? In other words, if I walk into, let's say, the congregation at Corinth in the first century, and a prophet is prophesying, what would it look like? Okay, what is happening? So a couple passages, look at Acts chapter 15, verse 30. So when they were sent off, they went down to Antioch, they gathered the congregation together, delivered the letter. When they read it, they rejoiced at the exhortation. And Judas and Silas who were themselves prophets. Now listen to the verbs. They exhorted the brothers with many words, and they strengthened them. Okay? So what do prophets do? They exhort, they strengthen, and it involves many words. So it's more than just, nice job, way to go, keep up the good work. Okay? It's of some kind of length, and it's to the whole congregation. Then you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verses 1 through 4, and we get a further description of tongue speakers and prophets. And notice verse 3, chapter 14. On the other hand, the one who prophesies speaks to men for what? Upbuilding, encouragement, consolation. Now, the one who speaks in tongue edifies himself, but the one who prophesies edifies the church. Okay? And so we get words like upbuilding, encouragement, consolation, edification, strengthening, okay, to the whole body of believers. And so if I'm walking into Corinth and someone is prophesying, there's someone standing up in front of the body of believers, and they're speaking, and it involves upbuilding, strengthening, encouragement, consolation. Later on in the chapter, we'll read about prophets' teaching. What does that sound like? Well, to me, that sounds like what I think of as preaching. But then that's kind of disorienting, because I always thought of preaching and prophecy as kind of two different things. Now, am I saying that, oh, goodness, look, they're exactly the same. They overlap exactly. Well, no, because you have passages like the ones in Acts that talk about Agabus, and there seems like there's a predictive element to prophecy at times, not all the time, okay? But when I actually look at the activity that describes a prophet, I'm not sure that I can say that it looks like this in terms of prophecy and preaching. I think it looks more like this, where there's a large degree of overlap. Yes, there's some difference, but there's a large degree of overlap, okay? And you can tell that I invested heavily in my visual aids today, right? Okay. Female prayer and female teachers. I'm not going to say a whole lot about prayer. You can see some examples there. Probably the most difficult thing about prayer is deciding what a prayer actually is once you start to look for evidence. So, for instance, when Mary has what's called Mary's song, is it really a prayer, or is Mary kind of breaking out in song, kind of like Les Mis? Initially, I kind of thought Mary's song, kind of like Les Mis. The more I think about it, the more I think it sounds maybe more like a prayer. Luke chapter 13, woman's healed, she glorifies God. Does that count as a prayer? Okay. So there's at least some passages there. There's probably some other passages that could be included. The final category is female teachers. There are some passages that mention females explicitly and teaching, Priscilla, prophets, teaching through singing, Colossians 3:16, and you can see some others. The two that I think are maybe the most interesting are the ones that have question marks there. And they have question marks not because something interesting isn't happening, but because it didn't use the word teach, teacher, teaching in it. And I really like 10 as a category, and I was really at the bottom of the page, and if I add another category, it's going to have to go on a second page, and 11's not as nice as 10. So I put them there with a question mark, okay? So it's not entirely fair, but I'm at least telling you that, okay? So look at Luke 2:38. You've heard of Acts 2:38? Look at Luke 2:38, okay? Luke 2:38 describes Anna, okay? 37 says she's a widow. Till she was 84, she didn't depart from the temple, worshiping with fasting and prayer night and day. So verse 38, she came up at that very hour and gave thanks to God and spoke of him to all who were looking for the redemption of Jerusalem. So we have a woman, and she's in the temple, okay? And we know that. Why? Because she didn't leave there day and night, right? Okay. So she's a woman. She's in the temple. Verse 38, she's speaking about him. Who's the him? Christ. Jesus, okay? To whom? Everyone who's interested in what? Spiritual kind of things, like the redemption of Jerusalem. Now, does it say she's a teacher? No. Does it say she's a prophetess? But I included her in the teaching kind of category here because it seems like she's giving some kind of teaching, some kind of witness, perhaps, to who Jesus is. And then the last one in our, 30 seconds that remain here? Nope, don't have time for the last one. The last one you'll have to read on your own, which is the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4, about whom the people in the village say, "We believe because of your testimony." Okay. What we did this time was purely descriptive, just describing what we see women doing when we look at the New Testament. And why would we do that? Because we think the New Testament is formative for the faith and practice of our congregations. That still leaves the hard questions of, so what are we going to do with this? Okay. But the first step is looking at the evidence. And I think it's important to look at all the evidence, especially before you go to the hot button passages. Okay? Because if you go to the hot button passages, first, what tends to happen is people share what they've always heard, what they want, rather than having new evidence come to the table. My experience is when folks actually look at the passages, there's some new evidence on the table. There's maybe some passages like me that you hadn't thought about and some women that you hadn't heard as part of the stories growing up in your congregation. Tomorrow, we'll talk about what does it mean to have a theology of gender? How does God think about male and female? Thank you very much.
Thank you.